mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Modern life is full of anxieties. Am I eating the right foods? Am I on the right career path? Am I reaching my full potential? But in America, there's always an answer.
You know, mostly we turn to self-help books in times of helplessness and sometimes desperation. You usually don't read a self-help book when everything is going great in your life. And one of the things that can be scary about a difficult situation is that you really experience this lack of control.
In her memoir, Promised Land, Jessica Lamb Shapiro explored America's $11 billion self-help industry to figure out why it attracts so many devout followers.
You're sort of returned to this childhood-like state where the rules are very clear and you just understand what you're supposed to do. I think that it causes a lot of anxiety being a grown-up and not always knowing what to do in every situation.
Today's show is all about self-help, self-actualization, and the places we look to find answers to contemporary problems, starting here.
Check this out. Stay in the state of certainty. Some of you lost it. Intensify it, whatever it takes. Intensify. Make your move. Come on. Make your move. Say yes. Say yes. Say yes. Say yes. Now feel it.
As off the beaten path as it once seemed, life coaching has exploded in recent years. From programs for high-end executives to individual instruction on finding a job or increasing personal empowerment, professional coaching is gaining on psychotherapy in America's long tradition of self-improvement. Genevieve Smith is a senior editor at New York Magazine and a contributor to Harper's. She wanted to know more about the business of life coaching and was given permission to observe and write about a 5-session training course on one condition, that she also participate. Genevieve, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So life coach, I guess many coaches now prefer to just say coaching. It's one of those professions that is often used as a punchline. But you found that's really changed in recent years. So when did coaching turn the corner?
Well, you know, and this is sort of anecdotal, but it seemed to me from observation that coaching really sort of changed after the recession, or after the recession hit, and people were really struggling with what to do next and where their careers were going to go. And the corporate sector was going through a lot of changes too. There were a lot of layoffs and downsizing, and coaching sort of stepped in to help those workers who felt really unmoored in this new economy to find their footing.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of licensing requirements are there for aspiring life coaches?
There are no licensing requirements for an aspiring life coach. Anyone can call themselves a coach and start taking clients and charging money. There are, however, professional bodies. There's one main professional body, and we have seen that the profession has gotten more professionalized. There are more people who are seeking out specialized training in order to become a life coach. That being said, the training is still pretty rudimentary. It's nothing like you would see if you were going to become a therapist or a social worker. It's 125 hours plus another 100 or so hours of real-world experience. So it's pretty easy to become a life coach. And really, as I said, you don't even need that. You can just open your practice, start taking clients if you wanted to.
But first, you were trained as a life coach. What program did you choose?
I went to CTI, mm-hmm. The Coach Training Institute. They're all the names of these things are so similar. So Coach Training Institute is based in California, and it's one of the oldest and most well-regarded of the coach training programs. It started in the early 90s, so it's been around for over 20 years. It has tens of thousands of graduates, and it was a 5-part course. Each part was about a month apart and were 3-day modules each one.
How much does it cost?
It costs, well, you know, for me, I was an observer, so I got away with not having to pay for it. But for the students in the class, it was about $6,000 to take the course. And then if they wanted to get fully certified, they ended up having to pay another $5,000 or so to do the extra training to actually get their full certification.
Well, you described some of these sessions, and there is a lot of the sort of jargony phrases like designed their alliance or danced in this moment or one of my favorites. What would your captain say about that? Some of the things that I would imagine in a life coaching or coaching course. But this language is sort of, okay, I'll go with it, dances between emotion and sales pitch. What do you think that relationship is there?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's both of those. I do think that it's tapping into real emotions and real problems. And that sometimes these crazy metaphors actually do seem to help people dig deeper. But it's definitely also a sales pitch, and it's definitely also a business. You know, the coaches themselves are trying to get clients who will pay them money for this service. The coaching school is also, it's created this program in order to convince students that this is the way that you train to become a coach. So it's really doing both of those things at the same time. And sometimes it's a little bit of an awkward juxtaposition to realize that, you know, this isn't just someone who's very sympathetic and very, you know, emotionally connected to you. This is somebody who wants your money.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the methodology, especially the things that I guess were very unexpected for you.
Well, I think the one technique that I found to be the most helpful in my own life was this idea, what CTI called holding the client's agenda, mm-hmm. which meant that if you are, you know, if someone comes to you for advice, right, your instinct is to say, well, here's what I would do. Or if you don't say, here's what I would do, it's say, well, I know you. I know what you want. And those are sort of our two, like, basic, you know, models of helping people usually. And what holding the client's agenda was supposed to mean is that instead of saying what you would do or what you would want for them, is you really try to listen to what it is that they want. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds incredibly simple and incredibly stupid, but it's actually a very hard thing to do. When someone comes to you and says, I don't know what to do with my career. I don't know, should I stay in this job? Should I go? And then what you have to say is, well, you know, what is it that you like about that job? What would it mean for you to leave that job? And you sort of push them to come up with the answer that they already have. And that I've actually definitely used plenty of times since then. And I find it really helpful and also freeing as a person giving advice or a person helping someone. It's freeing to not have to have your own agenda, to only want what they want for themselves. Mm.
Genevieve Smith is with us. She's a writer who embedded herself in a 5-session course for people looking to become certified coaches, life coaches. She wrote about the experience for Harper's Magazine. You spend some time in the article comparing coaching and therapy and finding that a lot of people are choosing coaching instead of therapy now. What do you think the appeal is now of therapy? Coaching over therapy?
Sure. I think one of the main appeals is that coaching comes across as non-pathologizing, right? I actually had a therapist who was becoming a life coach. And when I asked him to explain to me why, you know, after doing years of training as a therapist, why he was adding life coaching to his resume, he said that it was a lot of it was a marketing technique. He could go to somebody and say, hey, you know, I've just become a life coach. I'm trying to expand my practice. Can I offer you a session? Would you come and see me? And it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. Whereas if he, as a therapist, goes, I really think you could use some therapy, all of a sudden it makes people, you know, very defensive. Uh-huh. There's a feeling that, well, what's wrong with me? You know, I'm fine. And I think some of that is a little bit of a misunderstanding of what therapy is. But certainly for the average person, I mean, there's tons of people, especially, they found that especially men who are sort of more resistant to going to therapy, life coaching sounds great. You know, of course they want to improve their life and get more out of life. But, you know, and perhaps through that process, they're actually kind of secretly getting a little bit of therapy.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, you went into this sort of thinking that there was an idea of people might be seeking. Did you come out of it with a different idea about what people want in coaching?
I don't know if it was a different idea than I came in with. I guess, you know, there's sort of two aspects to this, right? There's why people become coaches and why people seek out coaching. And I was sort of curious about both of those, but almost in a way, I was less curious of why people seek out coaching. I mean, who doesn't want help, right? Who doesn't want someone who can just be like, here's the path, here's what you're supposed to do next, you know? And so it kind of made sense to me that, you know, if money is no object, if you're not embarrassed by it, then, you know, why wouldn't you want someone who can help you get more out of life? And I was really curious as to making coaching a career and how you sort of went from someone, I mean, clearly if you're going to a coaching school, right, your own life is in transition. You don't know what you're going to do next. You're embarking on a new path. So you're sort of the prime kind of person who seeks life coaching. And at the same time, you believe that you should tell, you know, should be a someone else's coach. And so I was kind of curious about that transformation and why people choose that. And what I found that I was sort of delighted by and surprised by was that, you know, the people going in there were genuinely nice people who really wanted to help people, and they felt that they had some sort of skill that they could bring to the table. There were a lot of people who'd had long professions, and they were now kind of, you know, phasing out of their main career, and they wanted to be able to do something that used all of their built up knowledge over time and all of their people skills and all of their desire to help people. So that I thought was really interesting to kind of understand why someone would choose to become a coach. Mm.
Genevieve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Genevieve Smith, senior editor at New York Magazine and a contributor to Harper's Magazine. That's where we found her article, 50,000 Life Coaches Can't Be Wrong. You find a link to read more at wordofmouthradio.org. While some turn to life coaching to navigate life's big questions, others probe more mystical realms. Reporter Sean Hurley isn't quite sure what he believes when it comes to mediums and witches and astrology. So to find out more, he visited two psychic fairs in New Hampshire and a quiet gathering of mediums in Londonderry.
It's the end of the day, and the psychics are tired. Julianne, who organized the Londonderry Psychic Fair, introduces me to Rich, a shamanic medium and healer.
Can you just bring someone in for him?
I'm really gone.
You can't, huh?
You look like you need a little rest.
See, yeah. See, everybody sees it. They're all making fun of
everybody
me.
Everybody knows.
After 24 sessions, Rich is ready for bed. So Julianne offers to do a channeling for me herself. It's a little shocking when she begins. Her face and voice both alter. I close my eyes and listen.
Oh, it is so good to see you here with us, a gear in hand, beautiful son of ours.
Julianne channels for another 15 minutes, and when she's done, suggests that I keep her message to me private. It's for me alone, she says.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own sort of journey towards this?
So in my earlier days, younger days, I was did a lot of palm reading. My first job, almost losing it because instead of hiring people based on their application, I was reading their palms. But no, I know he'll go to work. I've seen it in his palm.
Julianne runs her own staffing agency now and continues to rely on the non-traditional resume of palms. But she also sees people in private consultation.
You know, 100 years ago, there were times we trusted our instincts. We trusted our judgments. We all had a sense of knowing, you know, so I work with people a lot to bring them back to that place.
I get in the car and head to the Radisson, a faux castle with a glossy interior and a wing of ballrooms. In the Nashua North Ballroom, it's Sierra's Sweet 16 party. In the Nashua Grand, the premier bride wedding expo is underway. And in the Balsam and Wentworth Ballrooms, it's the magical marketplace and psychic fair. 60 vendors fill the room, selling everything from spices to chainmail. I glide by the homemade soaps and mysterious runes until I find myself standing before my magical weakness.
I got magic wands. Not your Harry Potter type wands. These are real wands, harvested by myself while hiking in the woods.
Dante, the wand maker, has been harvesting wands for 20 years. In the Balsam, I sit down with Judy Seidel, who works primarily with cards. When she sees my eye drift to her druid animal cards, she spreads them out before me. I pick three, and she turns them over. An eagle, a dog, and a snake.
The eagle is asking you to observe with new eyes. The dog is the guardian. The dog also is about being loyal to yourself, being true to yourself. The snake, you think of a snake shedding its skin, symbolic of rebirth and regeneration.
Across the room from Judy Seidel, Shah Blackburn, the loon witch, specializes in aura photography.
It's based on the principles of Curlian photography that all organic matter emits light and color. So you're going to have a seat in this chair.
Okay.
And then you're going to place your hands on these boxes. There's one on each side.
Now, is this the sort of photo you smile for, or you just...
You can, but we may not see it.
Okay.
Okay, you can take your hands off and relax. So that's you. I see you have this nice bright yellow, the lemon yellow here, and that tells me that you are a creative person, but you're not pursuing that creativity as much as you would like to.
My aura on the Polaroid photo also shows pain in my foot and neck, both of which are true. Both also could be said to be common human ailments. The question might be, is this magic or just universally applicable advice? And that can be as relevant as you like. For me, belief doesn't enter into it. I dream about eagles all the time. My ankle hurts. I have a creative project that I don't have time to work on. But regardless of magic, my attention has been refocused on each of these. I should take care of that ankle. I should get back to that project. So, when Julianne writes me an email later that night and expresses her hope that I found her channeling meaningful, I don't have any doubt or problem saying that it was. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Now, if you'd like to see a photo of Sean Hurley's aura, and I promise you do want to see a photo of Sean Hurley's aura, you'll find it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. When it comes to mysticism and unorthodox approaches to life's ambiguities, New Hampshire is far from an anomaly. In fact, astrology is on the rise across the entire country. But why, in the 21st century, are more and more people turning to an ancient and unproven practice for answers? The search for meaning continues on Word of Mouth after the break.